the disorder. There was a straightforward way to avoid this suffering: make sure the women had only daughters. In 1990, the British doctors screened the embryos of two women who carried X-linked mutations. One had a variant causing mental retardation, the other a potentially devastating nerve disorder. The women both underwent in vitro fertilization, and then the doctors plucked a cell from each embryo to examine. They used molecular probes that could detect a distinctive segment of DNA repeated many times over on the Y chromosome, and only the Y chromosome. The doctors set aside any embryo that tested positive and used the rest for implantation. 9 months later, each mother gave birth to twin girls. Because the babies carried a normal X chromosome from their fathers, all of them turned out healthy. By the early 2000s, it became possible to test embryos for mutations on other chromosomes, too. Karen Mulchinock, a woman living in the English city of Derby, had grown up knowing that Huntington's disease ran in her family. Her grandmother had died of it, and she had watched her father decline through his 50s, dying at age 66. Mulchinock got a test at age 22 and found she carried a faulty copy of the HTT gene as well. She and her husband decided to use in vitro fertilization to prevent the next generation of her family from inheriting it. In 2006, she had her eggs harvested, and her doctors tested the embryos for the Huntington's mutation. Over the course of 5 rounds of IVF, she gave birth to 2 children, neither of whom had to worry about the disease. "The curse is finally broken," she said. Couples who worried about other inherited disorders began coming to fertility doctors to ask for the same tests, tailored instead for their own mutations. When an English couple had their first child, they were surprised that she had PKU. Like Pearl and Lossing Buck, neither of the parents knew before that they carried a faulty copy of the PAH gene. The parents decided to have more children, using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to prevent their other children from inheriting it. After fertility doctors produced a set of embryos from the parents, they tested the PAH in each one. They successfully detected the mutations in some of the embryos and implanted the mutation-free ones in the mother. In 2013, they reported that she gave birth to a healthy boy. He was free not only of PKU, but of the worry of passing down a faulty PAH gene to his own children. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis has grown more popular as the years have passed, not just in Europe and the United States, but also in developing economies such as China. But the procedure is still rare. Despite the gripping stories of parents like Karen Mulchinock, only a tiny fraction of people affected by Huntington's disease, roughly 200,000 people worldwide, use the procedure. The cost puts it out of reach of many. Even in Europe, where the procedures are covered by government-provided health insurance, few people with Huntington's disease follow Mulchinock's example. Between 2002 and 2012, only an estimated 1 in 1,000 cases of Huntington's disease was prevented. Many children with Huntington's disease don't get tested themselves, since there's no treatment they could get if they turned out positive. Because Huntington's disease doesn't affect people until after 50, they usually start their families long before they find out if they inherited the allele. If they have a 50% chance of having Huntington's disease, the odds for their children are 1 in 4. They may be so busy caring for their sick parent that they don't want to bother with the time, money, and frustration that in vitro fertilization demands. In other words, we are not living in Muller's eugenic utopia. Nor are we living in a nightmare of the sort Aldous Huxley imagined in his 1932 novel Brave New World. Of the small fraction of people who are using in vitro fertilization, an even smaller fraction is using it to control the inheritance of their children. We have the technology right now to effectively eradicate Huntington's disease from the planet, along with many other genetic disorders. But the messy realities of human existence, of economics, emotions, politics, and the rest, override the technological possibilities. In April 1963, a microbiologist named Rollin Hotchkiss traveled from New York City to the town of Delaware, Ohio. He had been invited to take part in a meeting that must have felt at the time like a feverish dream. As Hotchkiss later put it, he and 9 other biologists spent a day together at Ohio Wesleyan University to consider whether man can and will change his own inheritance. One of Hotchkiss's fellow speakers was Herman Muller. Muller described to the audience his plan for sperm banks and germinal choice. To Hotchkiss and the other scientists, There probably wasn't much surprising in what Mueller had to say, given that he had been talking about his reform eugenics for more than 30 years. But when it was Hotchkiss's turn to talk, he described something that was fundamentally different from Mueller's germinal choice, or from any of the eugenic breeding schemes bruited over the previous century. Hotchkiss raised the possibility of directly altering human DNA. He used a new term to describe what he and some of the other scientists at the meeting envisioned: genetic engineering. It might seem odd for a microbiologist to talk about changing humanity's inheritance, but in 1963, Hotchkiss had come as close as anyone on Earth to carrying out genetic engineering. In the 1950s, he had begun working with Oswald Avery, following up on the original experiments on the transforming principle that turned harmless bacteria into killers. Hotchkiss and his colleagues performed more sophisticated versions of Avery's original experiments, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that the transforming principle was DNA. By moving this DNA into bacteria, Hotchkiss was effectively engineering their genes. In later years, Hotchkiss discovered how to transform bacteria in other ways, moving genes into microbes to make them resistant to penicillin, for example. At the Delaware meeting, Hotchkiss predicted that the same procedure would be used on humans. "I believe it surely will be done, or attempted," he said. After all, Hotchkiss pointed out, our species was always searching for improvements. We started by finding better food and shelter, and now our search had evolved into modern medicine. When Hotchkiss spoke in 1963, doctors were celebrating their recent victory over PKU, thanks to their ability to identify babies with a hereditary condition and treat them with a brain-protecting diet. "We cannot resist interfering with the heritable traits of the phenylketonuric infant by feeding him tyrosine at the right time to form a normal nervous system," Hotchkiss said. If scientists learned how to rewrite the faulty genes that caused PKU, Hotchkiss predicted, it would be hard to resist the temptation to do it in people. "We are going to yield when the opportunity presents itself," he said. Hotchkiss left the Delaware meeting convinced that the world had to get ready for that opportunity. Humanity had to think ahead to all the benefits and risks that the opportunity might bring. Hotchkiss gave lectures and wrote scientific prophecies. "Genetic engineering would not follow the traditional eugenic game plans," he said, "driven by government decree. It would instead be driven by consumers. People would be persuaded by seductive ads for the latest gene replacements to alter their own DNA." At first, Hotchkiss predicted, doctors would use genetic engineering to cure hereditary diseases like PKU in both adults and children, changing their genes as Hotchkiss changed genes inside bacteria. "One would presumably want to act at the earliest possible time in the development of the organism," Hotchkiss said, "even in utero." Hotchkiss could see the appeal of genetically engineering embryos. Doctors might be able to fix a genetic defect across much of the body if they could manipulate just a tiny clump of cells. But these doctors might accidentally alter germ cells, too. If those unborn patients grew up and had children, they might very well inherit the gene replacement, and they would pass the gene replacement down to their own children. "Now one is meddling with the gene pool of the entire race," Hotchkiss warned. "If a gene replacement turned out to be harmful, it would be bad enough to make one patient suffer. But if that gene was replaced in the germline, future generations could inherit the suffering as well. To Hotchkiss, the decision to alter the genes of people yet to be conceived was an assault on liberty. No man should ever be given total discretion to determine his brother's fate. The same held true for his great-grandchild." Hotchkiss turned out to be a pretty good prophet. To look into the future of genetic engineering from 1964, he could rely only on what little hard evidence existed at the time, much of it coming from his own crude experiments on bacteria. Within a decade, some of the pieces of his vision would already fall into place. Rudolf Janisch was breeding mice with DNA he had pasted into their genomes. Robert Edwards and Patrick Steptoe were growing human embryos in petri dishes. And by the mid-1970s, some scientists were even trying to cure hereditary diseases in people with Hotchkiss's gene replacements. They called it gene therapy. One of the pioneers of gene therapy was a hematologist at UCLA named Martin Klein. He developed a method for getting genes into mouse cells, jolting the cells with a pulse of electricity to open temporary pores in their membranes. As a hematologist, he turned his mind immediately to blood disorders. Blood cells came from lineages of stem cells nestled in bone marrow. If Klein could slip a working version of a broken gene into a patient's stem cells, their daughter cells would inherit it. He could thus create a lineage of healthy blood. Klein tested this idea first on mice. After injecting the engineered stem cells back into the bones of the animals, he waited 2 months to let them multiply. Klein then drew blood circulating through the mice and inspected the cells. Half of the cells had inherited the gene he had added. That was good enough for Klein. He immediately set out to use gene therapy to cure people. He chose for his disease beta thalassemia. This hereditary disorder disables a gene called HBB, leaving blood cells unable to build hemoglobin. People with beta thalassemia can die because their blood can't deliver enough oxygen around their bodies. To Klein, the need for a cure justified trying out his new gene therapy techniques on people. But when he submitted his proposal to UCLA, the university judged it reckless and turned him down. That didn't stop Klein. He went abroad, recruiting a patient in Israel and another in Italy. In 1980, Klein performed gene therapy on both patients. He extracted cells from their bone marrow and added working HBB genes to them. Then Klein injected the altered cells back into the patient's bones, where they could proliferate. The new bone marrow cells would inherit the HBB cells and produce working blood cells. At least, that was the plan. After the procedure, Klein's patients didn't experience any improvement in their symptoms. And when word got out of the experiment, the scientific community roundly condemned Klein. Not only had he leaped far beyond his studies on mice, but he had changed his protocol midway through the human experiment without telling anyone, not his colleagues, not the committees overseeing his research, not even his two patients. In the wake of the scandal, the National Institutes of Health took away Klein's grants, and UCLA forced him to resign as chairman of his department. In an editorial headlined "The Crime of Scientific Zeal," the New York Times even singled him out for condemnation. He was rightly punished, they declared. With all the news about Klein's reckless experiments, test tube babies, and human bacteria chimeras, a general alarm about genetic engineering began to blare. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter dispatched a commission to explore the ethical landscape of human genetic engineering, and soon after, Congress asked the Office of Technology Assessment to also look into the matter. They followed Hotchkiss's lead 15 years earlier. To dissect the ethics of genetic engineering, they split it into August Weismann's two fundamental categories, somatic and germline. Somatic genetic engineering, otherwise known as gene therapy, got a green light. Politicians and scientists alike agreed that it might eventually cure thousands of hereditary diseases. As long as the research went carefully, as long as the treatments were safe, no one saw any serious ethical concerns. The green light in the 1980s prompted a number of scientists to begin work on gene therapy. They needed, first of all, to find a new way to deliver genes to cells. Klein's method worked only for types of cells that could be removed from a patient, altered in a petri dish, and then put back in. If someone needed gene therapy for a brain disease, no one would try pulling chunks of gray matter out of their head. Viruses offered a promising solution. Scientists figured out how to paste human genes into viruses, which could then infect cells to deliver their payload. By the 1990s, scientists were getting promising results from viruses in experiments on mice, and they had even been encouraged by a few human trials. But it turned out the viruses were not as safe as once thought. An ill-fated trial for a metabolic disorder in 1999 brought gene therapy research to a halt for several years. One of the volunteers, a 19-year-old man named Jesse Gelsinger, had an intense immune response to the viruses. He developed so much inflammation that he died in a matter of days. After Gelsinger's death, the clinical trials of gene therapy stopped. The few researchers who remained in the field took a step back, searching for safer viruses. Within a few years, new clinical trials started, and after a few more years, they began to deliver promising results. Philippe Lebouche of the Paris Descartes University and his colleagues tackled beta thalassemia, the disease that had bested Martin Klein 30 years earlier. The French researchers extracted bone marrow cells from a boy, infected them with a virus carrying HBB, and then injected the cells back into his bones. In 2010, they reported that his cells started to make normal hemoglobin again, and he stopped needing a monthly transfusion of blood to stay alive. People who suffer from other diseases, such as muscular dystrophy and hemophilia, are waiting in the hope that gene therapy will help them as well. Instead of struggling with difficult diets, many people with PKU look to gene therapy as a true cure. In the debates over genetic engineering in the 1980s, almost everyone agreed that somatic cells were a promising target, but germ cells had to stay out of bounds. Deciding whether to engineer a profound change in an expected or newborn child is difficult enough, President Carter's commission concluded in its 1982 report. If the change is inheritable, the burden of responsibility could be truly awesome. When the Office of Technology Assessment looked into the matter, they agreed. There were too many uncertainties, both medical and ethical, to even investigate a technology that might someday alter heredity. The question of whether and when to begin germline gene therapy must therefore be decided in public debate, they concluded. In 1986, the U.S. Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, which determined what sort of research in genetic engineering could be funded, cut off the money. They flatly declared that they will not at present entertain proposals for germline alteration. And that, for the next three decades, was pretty much that. From time to time, a few scientists would rattle the regulatory cage, arguing that germline engineering would be a boon to humanity, not a threat. In 1997, the American Association for the Advancement of Science revisited the matter with a forum about germline intervention. The assembled scientists and philosophers granted that tinkering with the germline might bring good changes, but they weren't willing to give a full-throated endorsement for the idea. They warned that genetic engineering might someday offer us the power to shape our children and generations beyond in ways not now possible, giving us extraordinary control over biological and behavioral features that contribute to our humanness. And yet, even as the forum tried to peer into the future from 1997, that day had already come. A few doctors had gone ahead and tampered with human heredity in a way no one had ever imagined, without asking anyone's permission. In 1996, a woman named Maureen Ott went to St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey, in the hopes of having a baby. 7 years of in vitro fertilization had failed. Her eggs seemed healthy, but whenever her doctors implanted embryos in her uterus, they stopped dividing. Now, at age 39, Ott was watching her biological clock wind down. She came to Livingston because she had heard that doctors there had found a way to rejuvenate eggs. The St. Barnabas team, led by a French-born doctor named Jacques Cohen, had run some encouraging trials on mice. In the experiments, they drew off a little of an egg's jelly-like filling, its ooplasm, and injected it into a second defective egg. This microscopic injection raised the odds that the defective egg would develop into a healthy mouse embryo. The researchers speculated that the procedure worked because molecules from the donor egg undid some unknown damage. If the procedure worked on mice, it might also work on humans. Cohen and his colleagues recruited healthy young women to donate eggs for a study. The doctors would draw off ooplasm from the donated eggs and inject it into the eggs of women struggling to have children, women like Ott. Ott's doctors warned her that the procedure was far from a sure thing. Ooplasm contains many different kinds of molecules. Some of those might rejuvenate an embryo, but others might cause harm. It was even possible that the doctors might inject some mitochondria from the donor eggs into the eggs of the patients. If that happened, any children born through the procedure would inherit the mitochondrial DNA from the donor. Its genetic inheritance would come from three people instead of two. To Ott, the prospect of her child inheriting someone else's genes wasn't a reason to stop. Mitochondria were merely responsible for making fuel and for other basic tasks in the cell. They didn't create the traits that defined a person. If I was doing something like, say, I only wanted a blonde-haired girl, I would feel that was unethical, Ott later explained to a reporter. Cohen's team injected ooplasm into 14 of Ott's eggs. They fertilized the treated eggs with her husband's sperm, and 9 of the embryos began to divide. 9 months later, in May 1997, Ott gave birth to a healthy baby girl, Emma. A cursory look at Emma's cells revealed no sign of the donor's mitochondria. 2 months after Emma's birth, Cohen's team published an account of Ott's unprecedented experience in The Lancet. Newspapers reported in awe about the revival of Ott's flagging eggs. Other couples struggling to get pregnant besieged Cohen's team. Fertility specialists in the United States and abroad used the Lancet paper as a cookbook recipe for performing ovoplasm transfers of their own. But it didn't take long for the enthusiasm to curdle into suspicion. In June 1998, a Sunday Times journalist named Lois Rogers reported how doctors in California were offering ovoplasm transfer to their own patients. Rogers didn't portray the effort as a way to help would-be parents. In her articles, it turned into a dangerous experiment in heredity. Rogers said that embryologists and politicians were fretting that the treatment is being given without a full debate over the biological and ethical implications of a child inheriting genes from two mothers. What the doctors were actually doing, Rogers wrote, was creating the three-parent child. That turn of phrase locked into the public consciousness and proved impossible to shake off. A Canadian columnist named Naomi Lacritz railed against the quest for three-parent children, attacking doctors for concerning themselves only about the science involved. "Never mind science," Lacritz declared. "What about the ethical implications of cooking up a human omelet, which results in the hapless child carrying the genetic material of two mothers?" In 2001, the fear of three-parent babies flared even higher when Cohen and his colleagues published a new paper on their work. They closely examined the DNA of some of the babies that had developed from their rejuvenated eggs. Cohen's team found two children with a mix of mitochondria from their mother and the ovoplasm donor. This report is the first case of human germline genetic modification resulting in normal, healthy children, the researchers announced. By then, dozens of children had been born through ovoplasm transfers. Some of them were probably genetically modified as well. Despite two decades of government-sanctioned hand-wringing over genetic engineering, fertility specialists had waltzed right over Weizmann's barrier. The rules that had been put in place had applied only to research funded with government grants. Cohen and his colleagues, working at a clinic, had done their work in private. That freedom didn't last much longer. A month after Cohen and his colleagues published their report, they received a letter from the FDA. So did all the other American fertility clinics that were performing ovoplasm transfers. The FDA pointed out that it had jurisdiction over the procedure. From now on, it would give ovoplasm transfer an official status as an investigational new drug. That designation meant that anyone who wanted to try to carry it out would first have to fill out a mountain of paperwork and follow a lengthy set of procedures to make sure it was safe. Big pharmaceutical companies could handle those demands, but not small fertility clinics. Cohen and the other ovoplasm transfer practitioners in the United States gave up. But two American doctors, Jamie Griffo and John Zhang of New York University School of Medicine, refused to stop. When the FDA sent out their letter in 2001, Griffo and Zhang had been working on an advanced version of ovoplasm transfer. Instead of using a bit of ovoplasm from a donor egg, they wanted to try using all of it. They would put a woman's nucleus into a donor's nucleus-free egg. Now unable to carry out their work in the United States, Griffo and Zhang went to China. There, they collaborated with doctors at Sun Yat-sen University, looking for struggling parents who would volunteer for a study. The doctors carefully removed the entire nucleus from each donated egg. They replaced the original nucleus with a nucleus from one of the patient's unfertilized eggs. After they fertilized the egg with the partner sperm, the new zygote began to divide in a normal fashion. Chinese doctors at a local hospital implanted embryos from this procedure into a 30-year-old woman. Three of the embryos went on to develop regular heartbeats. Griffo, Zhang, and their colleagues urged the woman and her partner to come to the United States to get better medical care, but the couple decided to stay at the local hospital. About a month later, their doctors decided to remove one of the embryos to improve the odds of survival for the other two, despite protests from the Sun Yat-sen team. The remaining twins developed for another 4 months. Then one fetus's amniotic sac burst, and it died soon after an early delivery. The woman developed an infection, possibly due to the delivery of the first baby, and the second baby died as well. Although the experiment ended in heartbreak for the would-be parents, Griffo and Zhang saw it as a step forward for the procedure. With a fresh supply of ovoplasm, the woman's embryos had developed normally, and they might have even survived if she had gotten better prenatal care. In 2003, the scientists decided to present their results at a conference and share the news with reporters from the Wall Street Journal. Interviewed 13 years later by The Independent, Zhang said he regretted that decision. I think some of my team members were so eager to be famous, he said, they wanted to let the whole world know. The world greeted the news not with celebration they hoped for, but with dismay. Critics said that Zhang and his colleagues were veering recklessly toward the manufacture of human clones. The Chinese government responded by banning the procedure, effectively ending all research on ooplasm. The experience was such a catastrophe that Zhang and his colleagues didn't even publish details of the case until 2016. There was too much heat, Zhang said. This line of research might have ground to a complete halt if not for a few scientists in England and the United States who quietly continued running experiments on mice. They did not want to invent a way to help infertile parents have children, however. They wanted to stop mitochondrial diseases. The discovery of mutations that caused mitochondrial diseases made it possible to diagnose mysterious illnesses and make sense of their strange heredity. But it didn't immediately point to any straightforward cure. In 1997, a British biologist named Leslie Orgel proposed a different line of attack. Rather than curing the disease, doctors could block its inheritance. In the journal Chemistry and Biology, Orgel published a diagram showing how to move the nucleus of a fertilized egg into another egg that had its nucleus removed. No longer burdened with defective mitochondria, the egg could give rise to a healthy child. Orgel gave his speculative procedure a name, mitochondrial replacement. By the mid-2000s, scientists had learned enough about mitochondria and manipulating cells to try to turn Orgel's idea into real medicine. In the United States, Shukret Mitalipov launched a series of experiments at Oregon Health and Science University. He found that mitochondrial replacement therapy could cure sick mice. Then he successfully carried out the same procedure on monkeys. The monkeys grew to adulthood without any sign of harm. Meanwhile, at Newcastle University in England, Doug Turnbull led an effort on a different method that also yielded promising results. Both teams then experimented on human embryonic cells and found that mitochondrial replacement therapy might work in our species, too. With these results in hand, Mitalipov and Turnbull went to their respective governments to ask for permission to push mitochondrial replacement therapy toward clinical trials. Their requests opened up a fresh debate about the wisdom of human genetic engineering. Much of the debate revolved around strictly medical questions. Would mitochondrial replacement therapy be safe and effective? Thanks to the ooplasm transfers of the 1990s, it was possible to get a few clues. By the early 2010s, the children born through the procedures had become genetically modified teenagers. Cohen and his colleagues tracked down 14 of the children and found that they were going to school, trying out for cheerleading squads, getting braces, taking piano lessons, and doing all the things that teenagers typically do. Some of them had medical conditions, ranging from obesity to allergies, but these were nothing beyond what you'd expect from a group of ordinary teenagers. Still, promising as the survey might be, it was too small to put concerns about safety to rest. And there was no telling whether the teenagers might develop medical problems later in life. Some critics also raised doubts about how effective mitochondrial replacement therapy could ever be. When researchers hoisted a nucleus out of a woman's egg, it didn't slip out cleanly. Sometimes mitochondria remained stuck to its sides. After the researchers plunged the nucleus into a donated egg, the embryo that resulted would sometimes end up with a mixture of old and new mitochondria. Even if 99% of the mitochondria in the embryo came from the donor egg, the 1% from the mother might still put a child at risk. Making matters worse, that dangerous 1% might increase as the cells in the embryo divided. Even if doctors could scrub all the old mitochondria from a nucleus, there might still be risks from mitochondrial replacement therapy. Many of the proteins that generate fuel inside mitochondria are encoded in genes in the nucleus. Once the cell makes those proteins, it has to ferry them into the mitochondria, where they have to cooperate with the mitochondria's own proteins. Some researchers wondered if mitochondrial replacement therapy would create a mismatch between the proteins, causing the mitochondria to malfunction. To test for this mismatch, scientists carried out mitochondrial replacement therapy on mice. They gave some of their animals mitochondria from a genetically identical donor, while others got genetically distinct ones. In some trials, genetic mismatches led to troubling problems. Some mice became obese. Others had trouble learning. Some differences in the mice, such as the amount of fat in their heart and liver, appeared only late in life. Since mice have such short lives, the researchers had to wait only a matter of months to see the symptoms emerge. In humans, it might take decades to discover such side effects. Some researchers urged that only genetically similar donors provide their mitochondria. But a lot of the debates over mitochondria replacement therapy were driven not by concerns over safety, but by deeper passions. After all, people were talking about making three-parent babies. To tamper with heredity was deeply frightening to many people. In a 2014 congressional hearing, Jeff Fortenberry, a representative from Nebraska, condemned mitochondrial replacement therapy as the development and promotion of genetically modified human beings with the potential for unknown, unintended, and permanent consequences for future generations of Americans. If it sounded like Fortenberry was describing a living nightmare, he didn't mind. These scenarios scare people, he said, and I would be very worried if it didn't scare people. Fortenberry cast genetic engineering as a kind of hereditary plague. Once a tampered gene was introduced into one child's DNA, it would sweep through a country like a vicious strain of influenza. But that's not how heredity works. It's been estimated that only 12,423 women in the United States are at risk of passing down mitochondrial diseases to their children. If every last one of those women underwent mitochondrial replacement therapy before having children, the result would be barely detectable. The mitochondrial DNA from the donors would become slightly more common among people in the United States. As the next generation had children of their own, that donated DNA would not become any more common. The gene pool of the United States, and the rest of the world for that matter, would barely ripple. To opponents like Fortenberry, mitochondrial replacement therapy not only threatened the future, but desecrated the past. Every child born through the procedure had inherited their genes in a manner unlike anyone born before 1997. And any person who was a source of genes became, by definition, a parent. The three-parent label, first stamped on ooplasm transfer, was now attached to mitochondrial replacement therapy. The creation of three-parent embryos is not an innocuous medical treatment, Fortenberry warned. It is a macabre form of eugenic human cloning. There's nothing macabre about the teenagers who inherited mitochondria through ooplasm transfer, and there's nothing about the egg donors that merits the word parent, no matter how often congressmen and headline writers use it. We don't hand out such an important title so carelessly. When women get eggs from donors, complete with nuclear DNA from another woman, they still get to be called their children's mothers. While opponents of mitochondrial replacement therapy have resorted to fear-mongering at times, its supporters have sometimes lapsed into faulty logic of their own. One common strategy is to play down the importance of mitochondrial DNA. In 1997, Maureen Ott convinced herself that she wasn't crossing a moral line because she wasn't picking out meaningful traits, like the color of her daughter's hair. 17 years later, the United Kingdom's Department of Health made much the same argument in a favorable report on mitochondrial replacement therapy they published in 2014. Mitochondrial donation techniques do not alter personal characteristics and traits of the person, the report declared. Genetically, the child will indeed have DNA from three individuals, but all available scientific evidence indicates that the genes contributing to personal characteristics and traits come solely from the nuclear DNA, which will only come from the proposed child's mother and father. When I read the report, I scoured it for a definition of personal characteristics and traits. I found nothing. As best I could tell, the authors dismissed mitochondria as doing nothing more than producing fuel. Meanwhile, I could only conclude the genes inside the nucleus handled the really important stuff, like coloring our hair. Ranking genes this way is absurd. The entire point of mitochondrial replacement therapy is to change something profound about a person, to take away a mitochondrial disease. People who inherit mitochondrial mutations may end up with traits that profoundly influence their lives and their identity, from a short stature to weakened muscles to blindness. Indeed, the huge range of symptoms that mitochondrial diseases can cause reveals just how many parts of our lives are influenced by the way we produce fuel for our cells. And there's no organ where fuel production matters more than in the brain, where neurons have to burn a lot of it to fire signals. Some mitochondrial mutations affect the way certain parts of the brain function. Others slow down the migration of neurons through the brain during its development so that they fail to reach their destinations. If altering the brain can't affect personal characteristics and traits, I can't imagine what could. Mitochondria have also turned out to be important for other functions besides generating fuel. Some proteins that mitochondria produce make their way into the nucleus, where they relay signals to thousands of genes there. Genetic variations in mitochondria can thus do much more than cause rare hereditary diseases. They can influence how long we live, how fast we run, how well we handle breathing at high altitudes. Genetic variants in mitochondrial DNA can influence our ability to remember things. Some mutations have been implicated in psychiatric disorders such as schizophrenia. The UK report helped persuade Parliament to take up the matter of mitochondrial replacement therapy. The Health Minister, Jane Ellison, reassured MPs that the procedure merely replaced a cell's battery packs. In 2015, Parliament voted to approve mitochondrial replacement therapy, and in March 2017, a fertility clinic in Newcastle won the first license to perform the procedure. The deliberations in the United States veered off onto a different path. In a survey of people with mitochondrial mutations, they overwhelmingly said mitochondrial replacement therapy research was worthwhile. The National Academy of Sciences examined the evidence and came out in 2016 with a cautious endorsement. It might be wise to start using the procedure only on sons, they said, since they wouldn't be able to pass on their altered mitochondria to their own children. Scientists would also need to keep careful tabs on the children born to women who underwent the mitochondrial replacement therapy to make sure they didn't suffer unexpected harm years later. But all these discussions ended up being moot. Somebody in Congress, no one has ever figured out who exactly, slipped a 10-line provision into an enormous 2016 spending bill that blocked the FDA from evaluating mitochondrial replacement therapy. Without any debate in Congress, the ban went into effect. In that same year, however, John Zhang, who had gone to China back in 2003 to continue his research, announced that he and his colleagues had taken another trip outside of the United States to perform the first human mitochondrial replacement therapy. Now working at the New Hope Fertility Center in New York City, Zhang had been contacted by a couple in Jordan for help. Their two children had developed Lee syndrome, a rare mitochondrial disease that weakens the muscles, damages the brain, and usually leads to death in childhood. The couple's first child died at age 6, their second at just 8 months. Before having children, the mother had no idea that she carried Lee syndrome. In her own cells, only about a quarter of her mitochondria carried the mutation, while the rest functioned normally. In both her children, her mutant mitochondria became more common and crossed the deadly threshold. The couple came to Zhang in the hopes of having another child, one without Lee syndrome. He knew he couldn't use mitochondrial replacement therapy in the United States, but he also knew that Mexico had no regulations in place that would block him. He traveled there with the couple, carrying out the procedure at a branch of his clinic. Zhang's team transferred 5 nuclei from the woman's eggs to donor eggs, which they then fertilized. When they implanted one of the embryos in the woman's uterus, it developed normally, and in April 2016, she gave birth to a boy. When Zhang and his colleagues examined the boy, his health seemed good, but the doctors found that his mother's faulty mitochondria had not been entirely replaced. 2% of the mitochondria in cells they sampled from his urine came from his mother. In cells from his foreskin, that fraction jumped to 9%. No one could say for sure what the levels were in his heart or his brain, and it was doubtful that anyone would ever find out. Barring some unforeseen medical emergency, his parents refused any further testing. The boy slipped away from science's gaze, another genetically engineered child brought into this world. Chapter 18, Orphaned at Conception. To Jennifer Doudna, mitochondrial replacement therapy looked like a faint foreshadowing of what CRISPR might deliver. Doctors like Zhang were only replacing faulty genes in embryos with healthy ones. CRISPR might allow them to rewrite any of the 20,000 or so protein-coding genes sitting on an embryo's chromosomes, and that change could be inherited by their descendants. The last thing Doudna wanted was for CRISPR to replay the botched history of mitochondrial replacement therapy. That treatment had crept into practice without any public discussion of its ethics, and when the conversation finally got off to a late start, It was distorted by lurid visions of Frankenstein and charged language about three-parent babies. In 2014, Doudna decided that she would try to avoid such a debacle by starting a public conversation. It was not a role Doudna relished. She felt comfortable talking about the inner workings of bacteria, not about the potential dangers of retooling human embryos. Her new role felt foreign, she later said, almost transgressive. Doudna started small. In January 2015, she hosted a meeting at a cozy inn in the Napa Valley, about an hour from Berkeley. Among the 18 people who assembled in wine country to talk about CRISPR were David Baltimore and Paul Berg, two eminent biologists who had led similar meetings in the 1970s to discuss recombinant DNA. Now, as then, Weizmann's barrier split the conversation in two. The Napa group divided their time talking about tinkering with somatic cells and germ cells. CRISPR might prove superior to viruses as gene therapy, the researchers speculated, because doctors could use it to fix somatic cells with more precision. As for the germline, some people at the Napa meeting weren't bothered by the prospect of using CRISPR to alter it. Others considered Weizmann's barrier a line never to be crossed. Despite their differences, everyone at the meeting knew that they couldn't just let their differences lay idle. There wasn't time. There were rumors that scientists in China had already used CRISPR on a human embryo. A paper from the scientists was supposedly circulating among journals for publication. Any day now, the news might break. Most of the participants at the Napa meeting agreed to co-author a commentary, which they'd submit to a journal. On March 19th, Doudna and 17 fellow scientists published a piece in Science called A Prudent Path Forward for Genomic Engineering and Germline Gene Modification. The scientists didn't call for an outright ban on human germline engineering, but they did strongly discourage it for now. They also proposed that a public meeting take place, bringing experts together from around the world to drill deeper into the risks and benefits of the new technology. Even such a big gathering as that would not be enough to settle matters, Doudna and her co-authors warned. At present, the potential safety and efficacy issues arising from the use of this technology must be thoroughly investigated and understood before any attempts at human engineering are sanctioned, if ever, for clinical testing, they declared. The science piece drew so much attention that the National Academy of Sciences agreed to host an international meeting just a few months later, and the Royal Society and the Chinese Academy of Sciences signed on to participate. Things were unfolding as Doudna had hoped, at least for a few weeks. In April, she discovered that the rumors she'd been hearing were true. Junju Huang, a biologist at Sun Yat-sen University, and his colleagues reported that they had crossed the line. They had used CRISPR to alter human embryos. Depending on how you looked at it, Huang's experiment was a historic achievement or a botched non-story. As the Chinese scientists explained in the journal Protein and Cell, they set out to alter the HBB gene, the gene in which mutations can cause beta thalassemia. They designed the experiment to sidestep ethical concerns about tinkering with viable embryos. When fertility clinics fertilize eggs, they sometimes make mistakes, allowing two sperm to fuse to a single egg. These embryos end up with three sets of chromosomes, hence their name, triploid, and they fail to develop for more than a few cell divisions. Huang and his colleagues got hold of dozens of triploid embryos to study, confident in the knowledge that these embryos could never be used to start a pregnancy, even if someone wanted to. Huang and his colleagues built CRISPR molecules that could cut part of HBB genes, allowing them to be replaced with a new stretch of DNA. They injected the mix into the triploid embryos and waited for them to divide into eight cells. Huang and his colleagues analyzed 54 of the embryos to see how well the CRISPR molecules had worked. They had only managed to cut the HBB genes in 28, and of those embryos, a smaller fraction had replaced the old DNA with a new material. In other embryos, the cells had accidentally copied similar genes elsewhere in their DNA. A number of the embryos, Huang and his colleagues found, ended up as mosaics. Some cells in the mosaic embryos had an altered version of the HBB gene, and some didn't. It turned out that the CRISPR molecules needed a lot of time to find their targets in the human DNA. By the time they found the HBB gene, the single-cell zygote had divided into several new cells, some of which ended up without any of the CRISPR molecules inside. When news of Huang's paper broke, I asked Doudna what she thought of it. She told me that it simply underscores the point that the technology is not ready for clinical application in the human germline. Doudna was choosing her words carefully. From the Napa meeting onward, she wanted to avoid turning public opinion against CRISPR in general. Her fellow scientists would have to restrain their curiosity and not carry out experiments that might seem grotesque or reckless. On the other hand, Doudna didn't want to rule out germline engineering altogether. Perhaps someday in the future it would be worth considering. Her careful parsing couldn't stop the story from spiraling out of control. It caused such a worldwide commotion that Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, released a blunt statement a few days later invoking the policies put in place in the 1980s. The concept of altering the human germline in embryos for clinical purposes has been debated over many years from many different perspectives and has been viewed almost universally as a line that should not be crossed, he declared. The NIH was pouring over $250 million a year into gene therapy research in the hopes of curing diseases by changing genes in somatic cells, but they would not pay anyone to leap to the germline, full stop. When scientists like Collins talked about a line that should not be crossed, they made it sound blindingly clear. Yet scientific research was only making it harder to find. Collins spoke of altering embryos for clinical purposes, for example. One could argue that an experiment like Huang's had no clinical purpose whatsoever, because the triploid embryos he used could never develop into children. Was his experiment beyond the line anyway, because someone might use the knowledge he gained to alter an embryo's HBB gene and eliminate beta thalassemia from a line of descendants? In September 2015, the line got even harder to discern. A scientist named Kathy Nyakin at the Francis Crick Institute in London applied to the British government for permission to use CRISPR on human embryos. Nyakin planned to use CRISPR to shut down genes believed to be crucial for the early development of embryos. By seeing how the embryos then developed could give Nyakin clues about the jobs the genes carry out. She would study the embryos only up till they were about a week old and then destroy them. But, unlike Huang's experiment, Nyakin would be carrying out CRISPR on viable embryos. Did their viability make her research an affront to all that is decent, even if she destroyed them when they were still a microscopic clump of altered cells? The news about Nyakin and Huang brought an intense urgency to the International Summit on Human Gene Editing when it opened on December 1, 2015. At the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, David Baltimore welcomed the 500 attendees with a provocative kickoff, echoing Hotchkiss's words 51 years beforehand. Today we sense that we are close to being able to alter human heredity. Now we must face the questions that arise, Baltimore said. The overriding question is when, if ever, will we want to use gene editing to change human inheritance? The conference never managed to live up to Baltimore's provocation. It was an extremely low-key meeting, the reporter Sharon Begley observed, with more and more empty seats as it went on. For some scientists, the low-key tone seemed like an intentional strategy. They hewed to jargon-rich prepared remarks, not wanting to stumble over any ethical tripwires. At the end of the meeting, Baltimore, Doudna, and the rest of the organizing committee came on stage to deliver a consensus statement. It didn't go much beyond what the Napa group had agreed to 11 months earlier. The committee endorsed CRISPR for somatic cells, gene therapy in other words, as well as CRISPR-based research on early human embryos. They came out against germline modification in embryos used to establish a pregnancy, but they didn't close the door. The clinical use of germline editing should be revisited on a regular basis, they declared. For some of the scientists at the meeting, the real question about germline editing was whether it was even worth trying. If we really care about helping parents avoid cases of genetic disease, said Eric Lander, the director of the Broad Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, germline editing is not the first, second, third, or fourth thing that we should be thinking about. Lander argued that parents would be better helped in almost every case by pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. If they risked giving their child a hereditary disease, they could get the help of doctors to sort through embryos, or perhaps even eggs and sperm, to make sure their children were not born with the disease. Only after parents tried these measures without success would it make sense to edit the germline. A few of the speakers came out strongly against even this restrained approach to CRISPR. Marcy Darnofsky, the executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society, painted a dark future very different from Lander's. She envisioned an unregulated marketplace where germline editing would run rampant. "It's a radical rupture with past human practices," she warned. The risks of CRISPR missing its target and rewriting a different gene, for example, were simply too great. And not only was it dangerous to change a child's DNA, Darnofsky argued, but it was simply wrong. An embryo could not give consent for the procedure. And altering the child's genes was, when you came down to it, an affront to the child's individuality. Even if CRISPR worked splendidly, its very success might create unprecedented social woes. Darnofsky could picture a world in which the rich engineered their children's genes to escape the burden of disease, while poorer children could not. And once parents started trying to get rid of certain traits in their children, where would they stop? Deafness is not lethal, for example, but when Harry Laughlin of the Eugenics Record Office published his model eugenical sterilization law in 1922, he put it on the list. Would fertility doctors offer to knock out deafness mutations? Would other conditions, such as dwarfism, be judged intolerable burdens, too? Disabled communities might feel besieged before long. And once parents got used to altering more and more aspects of their children's biology, Darnofsky predicted, they might well start changing genes to enhance their children. "The temptation to enhance future generations is profoundly dangerous," Darnofsky warned. "I ask you to think about how business competition might kick in, with fertility clinics offering the latest upgrades for your offspring. Think about how the market works." Most of the scientists at the meeting shied away from even mentioning enhancement. One exception was a towering, long-bearded geneticist from Harvard named George Church. "Enhancement was coming," Church said, "and it would begin not with embryos, but with old people." Here's one way that might happen. 9% of older people suffer from brittle bones due to osteoporosis. Cells in their skeleton start to break down the surrounding bone, releasing the minerals into the bloodstream. Some drugs can slow down the decline by sticking to cells, making it harder for them to make contact with bone. But there may be a better way to treat the disease. One reason that cells break down bone is that in old age they make less of a protein called TERT. In 2012, researchers at the Spanish National Cancer Research Center coaxed old mice to make extra TERT by giving them an extra copy of the gene. Their osteoporosis reversed, and their bones strengthened. It's conceivable that doctors could use CRISPR gene therapy to treat people as well. CRISPR molecules would home in on the TERT gene in bone cells and edit it. The gene would behave as it did when the patients were younger, strengthening their bones. But gene therapy for TERT could do a lot of other kinds of good, too. The Spanish researchers who tried it out on mice found that it also reversed aging in their muscles, their brains, and their blood. It extended the lifespan of old mice by 13%. When the scientists treated younger mice with TERT gene therapy, the animals lived 24% longer. If CRISPR-based gene therapy got approved for osteoporosis in humans, people might soon clamor to get the treatment for a longer, healthier life. And if it proved to be more effective the earlier it was administered, then some parents might want their children to have that benefit from the very start. Why end life with good TERT genes when you can start with them? TERT was just one candidate among many that Church saw for enhancement. Editing genes to treat wasting muscles might lead to people enhancing their strength. Researchers are discovering ways to fight the decline in memory and learning that comes with Alzheimer's. Gene therapy could conceivably deliver the same results. And editing those genes in healthy people might enhance their cognition. Parents might choose to edit those same genes in their children to give them an edge in school and at work. "I think enhancement will creep in the door," Church told the audience. In one sense, Doudna's campaign was a success. She had succeeded in getting a conversation started. By 2016, CRISPR had cracked open its cocoon and was a full-blown media butterfly, the subject of regular coverage on television and in the newspapers. Doudna hopped from city to city to explain the awesome tools she had helped invent and to provoke discussions about its use. That conversation's center of gravity soon shifted in a profound way. The National Academy of Sciences brought together a committee of 22 experts, including biologists, bioethicists, and social scientists, to grapple with the science, ethics, and governance of human genome editing. In February 2017, they released a 260-page report on their deliberations. Instead of kicking the germline editing can even farther down the road, they came to a startling agreement. They endorsed clinical trials for treating serious diseases for which there were no other alternative treatments. In their report, the committee asked readers to consider the case of Huntington's disease. Karen Mulchinock was able to prevent her children from inheriting the disease by using pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Because she carried only one defective copy of the HTT gene, she could pick out embryos that inherited her good copy. If two people with Huntington's have children, however, their children run a 25% risk of inheriting the disease-causing copy of the gene from both parents. In these rare cases, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis offers no help. Genome editing might. The number of people in situations like those outlined above might be small, but the concerns of people facing these difficult choices are real, the committee observed. Shortly after the Genome Editing Committee released their report, Shukrat Mitalipov published an experiment that suggested that these clinical trials could very well succeed. Mitalipov followed Junzhu Huang's example and tried to erase a genetic disorder by editing human embryos. Unlike Huang, however, Mitalipov and his colleagues manipulated viable embryos rather than doomed ones. They did everything they could to keep the embryos viable, and while Huang's team used relatively crude CRISPR tools, Mitalipov took advantage of newer, more precise ones. For their experiment, Mitalipov chose a genetic disease of the heart known as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Mutations to a gene called MYBPC3 cause the heart's walls to thicken and falter. Without warning, people with the disease may die of a sudden heart attack. The disorder is dominant, meaning that a child need inherit only one copy of the faulty gene to develop a faulty heart. Mitalipov's team got sperm from a man suffering from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and used it to fertilize healthy eggs. They also delivered CRISPR molecules tailored to seek out the mutation on the MYBPC3 gene. Out of 54 embryos treated this way, 36 ended up with two healthy copies of the gene. Another 13 ended up as mosaics. By the time Mitalipov's CRISPR molecules made their way inside the fertilized eggs, they had already made a new copy of their DNA. The CRISPR molecules apparently edited only one copy, so that when the embryo divided into two cells, one had the defective MYBPC3 gene and the other didn't. As the embryo continued to grow, new cells inherited one version of the gene or the other. To avoid making mosaics, Mitalipov's team tried a new method. They edited the mutation-carrying sperm and then used them to fertilize eggs. In these trials, 72% of the embryos lost the mutation. Mitalipov and his colleagues found that their edited embryos developed normally for 8 days. If they had implanted those embryos instead in a woman's uterus, they might well have developed into babies with healthy hearts. I was on vacation with my family in a little English village in August 2017 when the news broke of Mitalipov's experiment. I had hoped to take a break from CRISPR, filling my days with footpath walks and visits to castles. But one day I walked into the local grocery store and spotted a newspaper with 4-cell human embryos scattered across its front page. "The cells that could end genetic disease," it blared. That evening I turned on the television at our cottage, only to encounter Mitalipov talking about his experiment. CRISPR was becoming inescapable. For all the attention the world gave Mitalipov's research, he didn't promise much from it. Parents who carry variants for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy can already use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to identify embryos that won't develop the disease. CRISPR might help them deal with simple Mendelian inheritance, which leaves them with only 50% of their embryos to implant, lowering the odds of a successful birth. Gene correction would rescue mutant embryos, increase the number of embryos available for transfer, and ultimately improve pregnancy rates, Mitalipov and his colleagues wrote in their paper. By narrowing his focus, Mitalipov made the ethical challenges of CRISPR seem manageable. He just wanted to improve the odds that parents could have healthy families. Likewise, other scientists who contemplated germline engineering with CRISPR simply wanted to cure hereditary diseases in the womb, rather than wait to treat somatic cells later in life. Within this narrow focus, a lot of the ethical concerns that have been raised about CRISPR seem less like dystopian nightmares than the everyday challenges that conventional medicine already poses. If CRISPR turns out to work reliably, we might well face a world where hereditary diseases are a bigger burden on those who can't afford it. But the cost of medicine has been a grave problem for generations, and many recent advances have made this inequality more dire. As gene therapy has inched its way to the clinic, companies have begun floating astonishing price tags